You know, I thought there'd be more people interested in Hindu theology. Oh, we were going to do. We were going to look at the commentary on the Brahma Sutra, weren't we?
I thought about changing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's do that. Let's do that. Not now. Let's do that in the last week. We'll carry that on.
Yeah, because we've got that time.
We've got loads of time. So today we're looking at Shaivism and the Shaiva tradition, Shaiva theology, really. So
I give a bit of historical background.
You okay with Shaiva?
I'm quite interested in Kashmiri Shaivism from the meditative point of view. I have a vague idea of it. How about you?
Yes, well, we've just covered the sort of understanding.
So, are you familiar with the... Hello.
Sorry.
I'll give a brief historical sort of overview, and then we can look at the text. Oh, it works. Great. So Shaivism is a worship of the tradition of focused on Shiva. And Shiva was a god who first occurs in the Rig Veda as a Rudra. Shiva means the auspicious one. And by the time that we're looking at, the medieval, early medieval period, there were two kinds of focus on Shiva devotion to Shiva from the Puranas. Do you remember the Puranas?
Mm-hmm.
The medieval devotional bhakti texts of mythology. And then this Puranic worship of Shiva, and these are Brahmins who were called Vaheshvaras. And then there's the non-Puranic worship of Shiva in the medieval period. And these were primarily two classifications. These are indigenous classifications called the Ati Marga, the higher path, and the Mantra Marga, path of mantras. So this is what gets you liberated, the path of mantras or the higher path. Now these groups, sorry it's a bit complicated, but I'll rush through it quickly. The Maheshwaras believed that if you did worship of Shiva, ordinary puja, brahmanical worship of Shiva, like orthodox worship, there were smarter Brahmins who followed the Smritis as well as the Puranas. When you die, you go to the Shiva Loka, the world of Shiva, at the top of the world egg. So here's the world there. So that's when you die, you get reborn there. Now the Ati Marga, these groups said actually that is very limited kind of view, that the true liberation is outside of the Shiva Loka, is outside of the world egg. And so they believe that through Shaiva initiation, they call this the Shiva Shasana, the teachings of Shiva. As you get Buddha Shasana, so you get Shaiva Shasana. And through initiation, Diksha, all of these non-Puranic groups thought that Diksha gave you access to liberation. And there was two groups, main groups, the Adi Marga, there were different subgroups in these. One particularly important called the Pashupatas that you may have heard of, who were terribly influential and powerful in India. So the Somnath temple in Gujarat was owned by the Pashupatas, and they owned great tracts of land in Karnataka.
Are they Brahmins?
Yeah, Brahmins. Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
well, not Orthodox Brahmins.
Not Orthodox Brahmins, that's right. So they rejected the... they thought that they transcended... The Ati Marga means the higher path or the outer path. And another, you know the four ashramas, the four stages of life.
Mm.
Well, they considered their path to be the fifth stage of life. They went beyond the Vedic Orthodox tradition. So there were ascetics who covered themselves in cow dung ash, and there were different stages to their worship, to their life. They lived in a temple, a Shaiva temple, Pashupata temple, in the environs, in a kind of monastic situation. And then at one point in their life, they'd have to get rid of their external marks of being a Shaiva and go out into the streets where they behaved bad in socially kind of way. Howling like a dog or pretending to be lame so that people would abuse them. And then they would get the good karma of the people who were abusing them. So the karma transfer. So they would get the merit of the people who shouted at them. And then the last phase of life, they live in a creation ground. So that would be, and then they, at death they would achieve Rudrasa Salukya, union with Rudra.
So all the pollution, they reversed all the purity.
Yeah, they're just right. They reversed the purity, but to a lesser extent than some of these other groups. Mm. The mantra mark would be a group of texts called the Tantras as their revelation. And the Tantras, all of these groups thought that they either superseded the Veda or transplanted the Veda. Most of them thought they were, some of them were very orthodox, but they thought that this tantric revelation was a new revelation which was added on to the Vedic revelation. And here there was two main groups. One was called the Shaiva Siddhanta, which becomes the normative sort of Shaiva worship and cities in South India, particularly in Tamil Nadu, although its origin is probably Kashmir. And then the non-Siddhanta groups. And those are often called Kashmir Shaivism. But it's somewhat... it's not quite like Kashmir Shaivism, because there's no... I mean, it wasn't restricted to Kashmir. It was particularly in the south of India and Nepal. So you find Kashmir Shaiva texts being written in Tamil Nadu and Kerala. But the Shaiva Siddhanta, so we're going to look at that next time. The Shaiva Siddhanta is what we're focusing on today, and this is the normative. As you can't understand, all the Kashmiri Shaivism and the non-Siddhanta traditions assume the ritual and doctrinal and the theology of the Shaiva Siddhanta. It's a bit like Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism, something like that relationship. So, and the Shaiva Siddhanta, particularly in Kashmir, flourished in Kashmir and then went to the south, where it got infused with Tamil Bhakti from the Nayanmars. Oh, sorry, the Alvars.
Oh, hi. Sorry.
That's okay. So just a historical background to this. So the Shaiva Siddhanta is what we're looking at. There's a number of theologians in this, particularly Bodhidharma in the south, King Bodha, who could have been a king, wrote a theology called the Tattva Prakasha, the illumination of the Tattvas. And this fellow here, who we're looking at now, Ramakanta, who was an older contemporary of Abhinavagupta, so he's probably about 950 to 1000, something like that. And they all have this honorific title, Bhaka, the good doctors of the Shaiva Siddhanta. So this is Bhattaramakanta. And so how do they do their theology? They do theology through writing commentaries on the revelation of the Tantras. And for the Shaiva Siddhanta, they revere 28 Tantras as revelation. Well, this is kind of a symbolic number, because the actual number vary, the actual texts vary, but they usually try to restrict them to 28. And one of those texts is called the Kirana Tantra, the Ray Tantra, the Tantra of the Ray or the Beam. And Ramakanta writes a commentary on the Kirana Tantra. And sometimes the non-Siddhantikas wrote commentaries on the same text as well to offer a different interpretation, a bit like the Vedanta tradition, really. So that's a sort of historical background. So we're focusing on the Shaiva Siddhanta, and we're looking at Ramakanta particularly, who's about 950 to 1000. So currently there's a fairly early work. Difficult to date these texts, but from about, they could be as early as the 7th century. And it's what the Shaiva Siddhanta inherits is mainly the Samkhya tradition of dualism, where you have, if you remember in Samkhya, you have two entities, the soul, the Purusha, and matter, Prakriti, which are eternally distinct from each other. And they inherit that view. And the details of the Samkhya system as well. But what they add is God, Pati, the Lord, Shiva. So they have three eternal realities in this system. Pati, which is Shiva. Pashu, which means beast or animal. And Pasha, which is bond. So as a Pashu or a beast or particularly a cow is tied with a rope, a Pasha, a bond. So the soul is tied by the universe. It's released through the grace of the Lord, Pati. So Pati is Shiva. And Maheshvara, lots of different words for Shiva. So this is the individual soul, Jiva. And this is the universe. Jagat. Well, sometimes identified with Shakti. Shakti is the power behind the universe. So Shiva, he's a transcendent god who has five functions, five actions. Creation, maintenance, he creates the universe, and he destroys it. So the dance of Shiva, dancing Shiva, he's creating the universe and destroying it over and over again in that famous icon of the dancing Shiva. So those are his three cosmological functions, and then he has a fourth function, which is liberation. He liberates souls, free souls. And his fifth function is concealing. He conceals himself. I think it's that way around. I can't quite remember if it's which. I think it varies. So you've got these five functions, the five kritiyas: creation, maintenance, destruction, liberation, and concealing. So he conceals himself from devotees, and he reveals himself to devotees. Why does he do that? He does that because of, like the Vaishnavas, because of krida, because of play. There's a Shiva Drishti says that as a king will dress up as a foot soldier and walk among the troops, so Shiva takes on the forms of the world and manifests the world. He also does it for the liberation of souls, so that souls can be liberated. So he's got these five functions. And the universe goes into a state of quiescence, and every soul from comes manifests, goes into like avyakta, so it becomes manifest again. So the Lord Pati, he creates eight gods called the Vidyeshwaras. The top Vidyeshwara is called Ananta, and Ananta creates the universe. So he's like a secondary god, an emanation, if you like, of Shiva, who creates the universe. So Shiva never gets his hands dirty creating the universe. It's done through Ananta. And Ananta acts upon the universe, which is in its potential state, and it's called Bindu or drop. So Ananta acts upon Bindu, and then Bindu manifests as the manifest universe. And then the souls who you've got these newborn souls
also in them. In a state of kind of quiescence, they then get thrown out into the universe to undergo reincarnation and be liberated. That's the kind of process that happens over and over and over again. And they have a system of 36 tattvas.
So the universe is manifest as a system of categories or tattvas which are recognized from the Samkhya system.
Now, so they accept all of the Samkhya tattvas, 24 Samkhya tattvas, but they had 11 new ones, 11 Shaiva ones. You got one?
Yeah.
So here we got. So you've got. Is this okay, everyone? You've got the general picture. Then this is the list of tattvas, the emanation of the universe. You've got Shiva, the first tattva is Shiva. What's sometimes called, it's actually the 36th tattva, so I've listed them the other way around. But and Shiva and Shakti are together the first categories. Now, what is a tattva? A tattva is an ontological category. It literally means that. Tat means that in Sanskrit, and tva means ness, so it's a that-ness or a this-ness. And it's, although this is a shared list of tattvas, there isn't consensus about how many there are, although 36 comes to be standardized. What the particular order is, although indeed that becomes standardized in the course of time. And it's unclear whether they're a principle or a category or a level of reality, because each of these 36 tattvas is associated with levels of the cosmos, bhuvanas. And the first five are called the pure creation, the Shuddha Sarga, and the rest of them are called the impure creation. So in the pure creation, you have these categories. It's... For the Kashmiri Shaivas, Shiva and Shakti are Shiva and Shakti, but for the Shaiva Siddhanta, they're tattvas. They're not actually the Lord, but they're the presence of God in the universe, Shiva and Shakti together. Shiva and his power, his consort Shakti. And from then are generated the first god, Sadashiva. Now, Sadashiva is the main focus of worship of the Shaiva Siddhanta iconographically. So he's got five heads, and you'll see pictures of him in representations. And Sadashiva generates Ishvara, Ishvara generates Shuddha Vidya. Now it seems to me that Sadashiva is a different way of talking about Ananta, but there are different lists here. So at the level of Sadashiva, you get these eight Vidyeshvaras, or eight Mantra Maheshvaras, different names for these characters, one of whom, Ananta, is usually called Ananta, but I think he must be Sadashiva as well, generates the lower cosmos. And at the level of Ishvara Shuddha Vidya, you've got these other beings, kinds of beings, or classes of beings called Mantreshvaras and Mantras. These are gods, really. So I think the complexity of this system is due to different... Somebody tried to make sense of lots of different systems and bring them all together. Trying to make, you know, making them fit. And Maya, so Maya is the first, number six, Maya is the first category of the impure creation. Maya means illusion or magical show or something like that. And that's Ananta acts upon Maya. Maya is in two forms, Mahamaya or Bindu. Bindu, the drop, as I've said earlier. And Bindu becomes manifest as Maya. And then all the rest of the tattvas develop from Maya. And Maya has within it three impurities in potential, which binds souls, which keeps us bound in the cycle of reincarnation. And these impurities are the impurity of individuality, or anava,
individuality, karma, action, and maya, illusion or delusion. So those are the impurities. And different categories of soul have different kinds of impurity, have different degrees of impurity. So in there, for a moment, turn to the right of this diagram. You've got experience, either the kind of experience in the universe. So you've got these high beings, the gods, the Vidyeshwaras who create the universe. Then you've got below them another group called the Mantreshwaras and the Mantras. And these are pure gods, pure high beings, who manifest in the lower creation as mantras, as sound forms, but are not bound. They're free, they're liberated. And then below them you get the first kind of soul who is trapped, the Vijnana Kala, the one whose characteristic is consciousness, Vijnana. And that kind of soul only has the impurity of individuality. So that's the only thing that's left in that kind of soul, that delusion of that residue of individuality. And the next kind of soul is the Pralaya Kala, or the Pralaya Kevala, one who is particularized by disillusion, they're also called Shunya Kalas, emptiness beings. And they only have two impurities, individuality and karma. So they go into this state of quiescence, and then because of their karma, they'll be reborn again in the lower worlds. And then you have all the rest of the beings called Sakalas, which is us, and dogs and cats and all those sort of budgerigars, they're all Sakalas. And they've all got all three impurities, including Maya. And it's the Sakalas that are trapped in the lower stages of the universe and are covered by these various coverings. There's Kala, which is the power of particular agency. Vidya, limited knowledge. Raga, passion. Kala, time. And niyatif, constraint, sometimes translated as fate. So these are the forces which govern the particular soul. And the sakala is also called a purusha, which is number 12 in the list of tattvas. So the purusha is covered by these coverings, or the soul is covered by these coverings. And here you recognize we're now in the realm of Samkhya. We're in Samkhya land now. So where you've got the rest of the tattvas are from Samkhya tattvas.
Like another layer of theory.
Yeah, like another
layer. Superimposed on it, isn't it?
That's right, it's another layer of theory superimposed on it, yeah. But integrated in quite a clever way. And then you've got Prakriti. Prakriti doesn't really develop from Purusha. Prakriti is a lower manifestation from Maya. So Maya evolves into Prakriti, which is yet a lower manifestation, which is characterized by the gunas, lightness, passion, and darkness, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And out of Prakriti, as in Samkhya now, we're just in familiar territory, you get the evolutes, buddhi, ahankara, manas, the higher mind or intellect, the ego and the mind, and then the five senses, the five organs of action, the five subtle elements, and the five gross elements, which constitute the physical universe that we experience. But above all that, you've got these 11 Shaiva categories that they add on. It's quite complex, this system. And it must have taken a long time to develop and evolve. But by the time of Ramakanta and his commentary on the Kirana Tattva, he assumes this diagram, really. And he gives his theology is really a theological justification of this structure. And he opens his text. His text is about the main Shaiva
categories: the Lord, the Soul, Karma, and the section that we've got is fairly near the beginning from chapter 1, which is on the that's view, which is on the Soul. So I thought we'd have a look at that. Do you feel lost so far with all this detail? Are you okay?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
All right. Yeah. Oh, I'll get you another one.
That's all right. Don't worry right now.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I can
share
for the moment.
Do we do more copy?
Okay then. Yeah. Go ahead. Right. Thank you. So this. Well, the text has opened. It's on the bound soul. And it's a dialogue between Uma, which is the goddess, and Shiva. This is Goodall's translation. This is volume 1, chapters 1 to 6. There's more to come. This is published from the from Pondicherry, the Institut Français, in 1998. So I think the second volume must be coming up pretty soon.
It's written in.
The text was written about the 7th century.
No, I mean the language is.
Oh, the Sanskrit. It's Sanskrit. Straight Sanskrit. Mm. Well, and he's done an English translation, an introduction.
So this is a commentary on a
previous, this is Ramakanta's commentary on the Kirana Tantra. Right. Yeah. So the Kirana Tantra is about, could be 8th, 7th century, could be as early as that. Mm. And then his commentary is a 10th century, late 10th
century. Has that been translated, the Kirana Tantra?
Only by Goodall.
Right.
Yeah. So he translates the text and the commentary.
Oh, I see, both.
Both together. Right. So after some preliminaries, he talks about the self. He starts with the soul, the individual bound soul. So if that is so, never mind about that. We're on page 109, on verse 14 from the text. This one, the bold type is the Kirana Tantra itself. So he just says, tell me, what sort of entity is this bound soul, this Pashu? How is he bound and how released? Ramakanta goes through various possibilities, various options. If that is so, that's the Sanskrit. But he's just commenting on that. So I'm ignoring what's gone before. I just want to bring your attention to the different positions that he disagrees with. After all, he says, for the Buddhist, it is the soul. It is of the nature of no more than a stream of cognitions, because it is at every instant perishing. And by some of those verses in the Upanishad, it is held to be impermanent as an effect of the cause, which is Brahma. For the Nyayikas and others, however, it is eternal, and for the Charvakas, it is composed of nothing but the four elements. But for the Vaisheshikas and others, it is different from those elements. And for the adherents of Samkhya, its essential nature is to be sentient, and to be inactive in its bound state, just as in its released state. But for the Jaiminiyas, that's the Mimamsakas and others, it both knows and is an agent. And for the Nyayayakas and others, it is invested with 9 qualities: cognition, happiness, unhappiness, desire, hatred, effort, dharma, adharma, and samskara. That's a trace, karmic trace. And yet for the Samkhyas, it is without qualities. Similarly, for those who believe in human effort, it is all-powerful and independent, and yet for those who believe in fate, it is dependent. And for the Digambara Jains, and for those among those versed in the Upanishads who believe that souls come into being rather than that being forever existent, it is not pervasive. And yet for the Niyayakas and others, it is all pervasive. So anyway, he's summarized his views of the self, which he then wants to refute. So on the next page, says, from learning to understand a multitude of such unfounded bad arguments, I am in doubt. Therefore, in order to remove that doubt, you should say which view among these is compassionately favored by the omniscient Lord, by his teaching, and it is in this system and is an authoritative means of knowledge because it concords with the Shaiva tradition. So he's saying, you know, this is right because it's tradition, this is what Shiva says, this is what the Lord says. So,
were they all in debate?
Yeah. By the 7th century, the positions were clear and they were in debate with each other. And not sometimes not so get Abhinavagupta favourably quotes other scriptures like the Buddhists, the Yogacharas especially. I think it was a fairly lively place, particularly in Kashmir. A very strong Buddhist tradition in Kashmir before the Shaivas. So he's going to assess them, which is close to the Lord. So it's moreover, the Lord should explain how it is bound, how the soul is bound. In other words, in what manner? Is it bound, as the Niyayakas and others hold, only by the body and by the organs of the sense, or, as the Samkhas and others hold, also by the intellect and the rest of the evolutes of Prakriti? This is a matter of doubt. And how is it released? By this is meant, is it by knowledge alone, as the Samkhas and others maintain? Is it by yoga, as the followers of Patanjali and others hold? Or by renunciation, as the Vedantins and others hold? Or by ritual actions, as the followers of Jaimini maintain? This they express in the following verse. If one desires liberation, one should not engage in motivated rites or forbidden acts. One should perform only one's regular and incidental duties. But one should do so not in view of any reward, but simply to avoid the negative consequences of failing to perform them. That's a classical summary of the Mimamsaka position. You do your ritual actions because it says so in the Vedas, not for any reward, but because it's injunction, and to avoid the negative consequences of not doing it. Thus, even here there is uncertainty, and so to remove that, the Lord should teach answers to the above questions. Now the Lord teaches the settled doctrine, the Siddhanta, for the removal of those eight doubts. I'm not sure what the eight doubts were. Were there eight doubts? There must have been. I've lost count, but he probably summarized eight positions which he raised as doubts. So this is the Shaiva position now, stated by the Lord in his text. This is the revelation of the truth of the soul. The bound soul is eternal. It has no form, is without knowledge, is devoid of activity and of qualities, is impotent and all-pervasive. It is situated variously in the belly and at the upper edge of Maya, and in deliberation among effects which can be grouped under the heading experience of accumulated karma, and the faculties of sense and action which can be grouped under the heading of the means to experience. So it's a long sentence there. So the soul is eternal, is formless, has no knowledge, is ignorant, and it's devoid of activity and of qualities, and it's impotent, it's powerless. And this is very odd, it's all pervasive. So the Shaiva Siddhanta doctrine was that at liberation, you didn't merge with Shiva, you didn't become one with Shiva, but you achieved equality with Shiva. So we call this Shiva Tulya, equality with Shiva. Because you're ontologically, the soul is always ontologically distinct from Shiva, and never merges with Shiva, but can attain equality with Shiva. And like Shiva, it's all pervasive, so the soul is all pervasive. So it's equal to Shiva in every aspect at liberation, except it doesn't perform the five functions. Shiva performs the five functions of creation, maintenance, destruction, concealing and revealing. But the bound soul, once liberated, is equal to Shiva, but doesn't perform those actions. It's a bit like the Samkhya system where the Purusha is liberated and all Purushas are distinct, but they're also all pervasive, which is a very odd doctrine. So this is the revelation. So what was his commentary on this verse? He says, by the scriptural statement, here that it is eternal, the Lord favours the arguments of the Nyayayikas and others, at the expense of the opinions of the Buddhists and others. He also says that it is without form. That which has solidity is said to be a tactile object endowed with a form composed of four elements. This verse says that it is not of this nature, and thereby at the expense of those Charvakas, that's the materialists, who opine that sentience belongs to the elements alone, favours the arguments of the Buddhists and others. I'm lost now in this sentence. This verse says that it is not of this nature, and thereby, at the expense of those Charvakas who find that sentience belongs to the elements alone, favours the arguments of the Buddhists and others. I see, who propound that it is different from them. So he's reasoning, he's kind of saying the Lord is favours the Buddhists on the one and the Ayakas on the other. Moreover, the verse affirms that it is without knowledge and that it is devoid of action, by which it is meant that it is devoid of the shaktis, or the powers of knowledge and action, in the akala states, in the unmanifest states, and in the state of the souls in samsara, it has limited powers of action and knowledge. It is thus referred to as agnya and nishkriya, without knowledge and without action, in the same way as soup is said to be without salt, when what is in fact meant is that it has very little salt. The Sanskrit word for soup is supa. It's interesting. Thus the Samkhyas and others are refuted, and favour is bestowed on the view of the Mimamsakas and others. But with the word nirguna, without quality, divine favour is bestowed on the Samkhyas and others' doctrines that the soul is devoid of qualities, and the Nyayakas and the Vaisheshikas' doctrine of the nine qualities of the soul, cognition, happiness, unhappiness, desire, hatred, effort, dharma, adharma, and samskara, is rejected. And with the words impotent, without power, aprabhu, it is taught as before, in the case of the words agnya and nishkriya, that the power of the soul is limited. Now here divine favour is bestowed in part both on those who believe in the power of human effort and on the fatalists, since the Pashu is powerful only in respect to various sacrificial acts like the Agni Shtoma, the sacrifice of the fire sacrifice, and the fruits of which, whether directly seen or not, can now be accumulated. But in respect of the consumption of the retributive force of previous accumulated karma, he is powerless. He's just clarifying what's meant in relation to these other positions. So the soul is powerless, relatively powerless, but only has power in limited situations like sacrifice. And then, but it's also all-pervading. By saying that the soul is pervasive, divine favour is bestowed on the Nyayakas and others who hold that it is pervasive. And those who hold that the soul is not pervasive are refuted. So he goes on like this.
So there are bits that he agrees and disagrees with,
yes,
in all these other doctrines.
Yes. Yes. So it's not a complete rejection of these other positions. So they're right in some elements, but they're wrong in the others. Now, what's the basis for claiming they're right or wrong? The only basis is revelation. You've got this verse that's dictated, as it were, by the Lord. So Shabda is the supreme means of knowledge, revelation, faith in revelation. And that revelation accords with reasons, a bit like the deists. You've got a revelation, and then you have your experience accords. You know, your reasoning and experience doesn't contradict revelation.
Is there any attempt at reasoning at all in any of the texts?
Not in the texts themselves, but only in like the commentaries.
Yeah, and
not in the revelation.
So there is a bit of attempt to justify it.
That's what he's doing here. He's trying to justify it in relation to these other positions.
Right, but he's just saying, you know, some are right and some are wrong. There's a mixture, but he's not actually saying why.
No. The only why is he goes into a bit like that now. The only reason why is because it doesn't this is the revelation, this is what it says, and he's just assessing which ones accord with it and which ones don't at the moment.
Yeah, which doesn't. Unsatisfactory.
It's unsatisfactory, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. And then he goes on, the next page, he's got a bit more argument, really.
Any reason for Garuda being the speaker?
No, it's curious, like, because Guru is Vaishnava.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's some thing about the Vaishnavas sort of getting, making them subordinate to the Shaivas. Mm. Could be.
Can you tell me this concept of liberation? Is it the same in all Shaiva tradition, Puranic and the Puranic?
No, in the Puranic, you get reborn in the Shiva Loka.
Uh-huh.
As a soul separate from Shiva.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the this Shaiva Siddhanta, you become equal to Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Kashmiri Shaivism, which we'll be looking at, you fuse, you merge with Shiva. So I think if there's only one reality. But here, in this tradition, you've got these three distinct realities. So he says, and that's because Garuda knows, that's earlier on, Garuda is a character in this. From this statement of the law, the doctrinal position of the other traditions, the arguments for the proof of the eternity of the soul, are not related here. Oh. For this reason, they are not related, and also because they are useless, since even without these arguments, one accomplishes the removal even of this circle of doubt by favouring one or other of the two sides, or by favouring the arguments put forward by one of those sides. Just as the removal of doubt is accomplished in the case of doubt about whether something seen in a poor light or from a distance is a post or a man, through the assertion of some reliable man, this is a post. So in other words, you have an arbiter, somebody who is reliable, who says this is a post rather than a man, this is what the soul is like rather than what the soul is not like. You trust their judgment without reference to your experience. Alternatively, he says, the fact that the soul is established by experience is expressed by the speech of the Lord, in which the various arguments are not related, since arguments are useless when something is established by experience.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. For example, an argument cannot apply, for example, to the assertion, this pot is round and made of iron, because in this case the fact is established by experience. And so because the soul as an agent of perception is also established by experience as something which makes manifest other things and itself, its permanence is established by experience, because that is how it is perceived. Well, I think we could take issue with Ramakanta here. What do you think of this point then, that the pot is round and made of iron? There's no argument for that, it's just by experience, you know that. You can't create an argument for the pot being made of iron and round. You either see it or you don't see it.
You're appealing to the evidence of the senses.
Yes, you're appealing to the evidence of the senses. So he said the soul is like that. So appealing to the evidence of the senses, you can see that it is permanent and established by experience, because that is how it is perceived. And that's a slightly odd.
Mm-hmm.
We all have an experience of the self, ourselves. And is it that we can't imagine ourselves not being anymore? Is somebody difficult to imagine your own death?
That's similar to Advaita Vedanta, isn't it? The idea that there's always this perceiver, and that's really the only constant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether he argues it very well, unless there's a lot more to it, but and he also seems to imply something different, because the first part of this page he's talking about you just take what an authority says as being true.
Yeah.
Now he's saying, well, you should really go by your experience.
Yes.
So it seems, from just his initial look.
Yeah. So he's, yeah, that's right. So there are the different means of knowledge, the pramanas, there are three, which is shabda, which is authority, pratyaksha, which is experience, and anumana, which is inference. So here he's saying that shabda is the first one. You know something by authority, the authority of the revelation. But experience doesn't contradict that authority, and in fact it backs it up. That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
because we experience ourselves as eternal. What shall we do? Well, you might think that. I mean,
we might.
Some do. Some definitely do.
Yeah.
It probably is the only thing that possibly could be eternal, because nothing else could, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything else fades, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it really proves, I mean, I don't know, maybe more from later pages, but.
Yes, it's really not a proof, is it, so far?
Well, I think we're coming to it with the 21st centuries of consciousness. Then we've been told over and over again that we're not, so we don't think like that anymore, but possibly then everybody did actually feel.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
There was some difference then.
Yeah.
In the inner experience.
Yeah.
Although, with the dream states, you have these breaks in the continuous sense of self-awareness in a way. So I don't know how really you would feel, you would get from the experience the permanence of your being. This contradicts that,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, Vedanta would argue that really, the dreamer is the same person as the waking state person, because the dreams relate to the experiences of that person, and there's some sort of sense of continuity. I mean, if you have a nightmare, your sort of heart pounds or whatever, so there's some sort of sense of continuity there.
I see. Yeah. Get over it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is good. I mean, I suppose the Buddhist position would be the opposite. That there's a flow of cognitions, but without any continuous entity underlying it, without any basis.
It's interesting, he says that, because there are lots of different Buddhist positions really on this. The Tathagatagarbha tradition, so there's the idea of the Buddha nature, so it's underlying everything, which is more of a continuity, really.
Yeah, that's right. There is, and the Lankavatara Sutra even talks about Atman in one chapter in that, which is very odd.
But
you've got that, the Tathagatagarbha, you've got that continuity. But I think who are the Buddhists here? He's probably referring to like Dharmakirti and that kind of the Madhyamika.
Or Theravadan.
Could be. In Kashmir at the time, the Sarvastivadins, they were the dominant.
Sarvastivadins.
That's right. And I think they've got you've got consciousness, the stream of consciousness, which is made up of these chitta karmas, chitta kshana, moments of consciousness, which come into being and go out of being. T1, T2, T3. So you might get death there, but the power behind this series carries on, but there's nothing in TN which has anything which shares anything with T1 in the Buddhist view that he's refuting. Now Nagarjuna comes along and refutes this and says, how can there be a chitta kshana which comes into existence at one moment and goes out of existence, and how can you maintain that and maintain that there's a causal connection between these different moments of consciousness, since you can't do that? So there's a Buddhist refutation of this model as well, the Sarvastivadi chitta kshana. It's like an old-fashioned film strip, I guess, It looks like it's moving, but you stop it and it's actually made up of discrete entities.
Don't they condition?
Yeah, that's the problem.
Independently originated.
Yeah, how can you make independent origination? How can T1 condition the next T2 if T1 is an independent entity which comes into existence and goes out of existence?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no contact, therefore, with the next.
But there's no start. That's the thing.
There's no beginning to it.
There's no beginning. So it's all continual. It's not a start process and an end.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the Buddhists maintain there's no beginning to this process. So, because some of the Abhidharmas, as far as the Abhidharma, said that each of these moments has got svabhava, which is very odd.
produced in many ways.
Being so, the Nagarja comes along and says, "How can you maintain dependent origination and Svabhava contradiction?" So these are empty of any Svabhava.
I think the Theravadins got over that. I can't remember what it was called, but they decided to invent another sort of entity that was underneath all these sort of
Pavanga. The underlying entity that.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a difficulty for karma, which is what everybody believed or seem to believe.
Yeah. Whose is the karma? That's right.
Yeah. So that's what happens if you try and get rid of the soul and the self and everything.
Yeah, that's the problem. You get all these problems.
Yeah.
So but then if you keep the soul, you've got all these problems.
Less problem, I would say.
So, I mean, also, if you're going to act ethically, one of the motivations is self-motivation, to get out of suffering. But if it's not me who suffers in the next life, why worry?
Yeah.
Is that a problem, I think, in Buddhism? So what's the answer to that, the Buddhist answer, is it's compassion. Compassion for that being who you will become. But anyway, so he's refuting that. You've got a soul here. You've got a soul. It was 11 o'clock, good difference. Let's have just a quick... Yeah, so he says, the permanence of the soul is established by experience and by revelation. And he has a slight go at the Buddhist at the bottom there, nor is it possible to prove its momentariness by means of inference, namely the argument of the impossibility of the efficacy of what is permanent, since that argument too is vitiated by the faults of being unproved and by other faults. And this too I have shown in the commentary on the Naleshvara Pariksha. So he's trying to establish the truth of revelation. And that the soul is established by experience and is undivided and is a limited agent. It's limited agency in certain limited spheres. And then he then goes on later on to describe how that happens through kala, through the first covering, the kanchuka of the soul, kala, the power of limited agency. He talks about that, how kala from Shiva joins this impure soul. And then he goes on. Did I give you page 201, the next stick?
I can't see the numbers.
No, I can't see the numbers yet. The bound soul consciousness. What's your last page? I can't remember. Oh, yeah, that.
Bound soul. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you carry on from there. Mm-hmm. The next page. Oh, that's the next page.
Have you got a verse number now?
It's 16. C to 17.
Ah, yeah, it's two after the color.
Oh, yeah. And then he says the text, the revelation, says the bound soul's consciousness is empowered by this kala, by this limited agency. The sphere of the operation of the senses is made known by vidya, limited knowledge, and it is also stained by passion. And matter, which consists of the gunas, is joined with the soul, and the soul is bound through its connection with the organs of the sense and action, beginning with buddhi and with the army of gross and subtle elements. So there we've got the tattvas coming into place. So he said that the soul is covered by the tattvas, the kanchukas, and also by the lower tattvas of samkhya. And then Ramakanta goes on to give an exposition of this as well. But so you've got a flavour of some of this kind of argument, the style and so on.
It's interesting having a contemporary view of the different debates that are going on.
Yeah, they're aware of each other and so on. Yeah. And so next week, we can look at the non-dualist response to some of this, to the Shaiva Siddhantas, if you like. And look at, I think we have got Utpaladeva, or perhaps Abhinavagupta's argument. For the identity of the soul with the absolute.
So the fundamental dualism of the Shaiva Siddhanta is that the soul will always be separate.
Yes, yes, always be separate, even in liberation. Mm. It just achieves equality with Shiva. It is slightly odd, that notion, because all souls in a sense are identical. They have qualities, but they're equal to Shiva, and they're all pervasive.
In Sankhya, the Ishvara was just optional.
Yeah, you didn't have Ishvara, it's near Ishvara in Sankhya, yeah. But you've got Ishvara coming in with this system. In yoga, you get Ishvara. Yeah. And Shaiva Siddhanta is still alive today at Chidambaram in Tamil Nadu there. Big Shaiva temple. But the intellectual rigour of it has gone. Mm.
Yeah, so sort of kind of looking back, you know, to a time when there was a lot of debate.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Perhaps we can sort of revivify it here in the West.
Oh, like Tibetan Buddhism, for example, carries on in a quite an intellectually vibrant way, I think. Mm. But not the Shaiva traditions. You watch Shaivism in the West now, but it's all
go on, say it.
You know, repeating a few mantras and being devoted.
Yeah, I mean, the Kashmiri Shaiva tradition with the mantras and, you know, the sort of Uttara of Om, you know, for example.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting.
Oh, it is fascinating, yeah. I agree. But you've got theologians here arguing their patch. You don't get that anymore.
Well, perhaps that's what we're doing here, you know, sort of bringing different views.
Well, you did get some of it. There was a book called Meditation Revolution by Mula Ortega and so on, who was they claimed to be Muktananda devotees doing Shaiva theology. Quite on. Yeah, that's quite interesting. Okay, so next week we'll do Kashmiri Shaivism.
Good.